Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's episode on Group Chat, your weekly podcast on everything disability. Today, we'll be talking about accessibility of advocacy conferences, and we have a very special guest with us. Hello, Mr. Knight.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Do you want to just introduce yourself?
Absolutely. My name is River Knight, and I do lots of different stuff. Most of what I'm doing at the moment is I guess you'd call advocacy work with what's happening with the Royal Commission and the NDIS review. So I'm talking a lot of stuff in the media. I also will help out running the biggest disability and NDIS events around Australia that are free. I also work with services and service providers who are trying to do a better job. And I work all around Australia doing that, which is good fun. And I spent the last 30 years doing that. And I'm also an adult with living with disability. I have autism, Tourette syndrome. You'll notice I've got a bit of a visual impairment as well. So my eyes won't connect very well with the camera. I've worked in that disability space for a long time. And I started out as a special ed teacher, and I worked in children's prisons, youth justice, child safety and public guardian, and with lots of different services all over Australia. So I've been very busy. I've been very hyperactive, sticking my nose in all sorts of places, and now working mostly in that bigger picture.
How do you prioritize which areas to concentrate your advocacy?
How do I prioritize my work? I find that I'm trying to focus more on things that will make bigger change. So at the moment, I'm trying to focus on things that might affect the way NDIS legislation ends up, how policy ends up. And I'm trying to focus on the bigger picture stuff. I feel like if we can get that right, then it's easier to work it down the chain to the services and the things on the ground and get them right. So I try and prioritize that, but I have a really interesting calendar. And I try and chunk all the different hours during the day and go, I'm going to do this bit on events, and this is going to be the advocacy, and this is going to be news, and this is going to be press releases, and chop it up that way. Otherwise, I get completely distracted, and I end up doing all sorts of things that are interesting but probably not what I should be doing.
Yeah, interesting. Such an honor to have you on the show tonight, Mr. Knight. We'll move to the next question. In regards to improved access and eligibility criteria, reform could focus on refining the criteria for accessing the NDIS, showing that those who genuinely need support can access it without unnecessary barriers.
I'm a little bit worried about that one myself, because any time I find that government says we're going to improve access, unfortunately, sometimes what that means is we're going to make it harder to access and we're going to cut out certain groups. And sometimes that's what that means. So I'm hoping this time it's not what it means. Access is a tricky one, but it's very broad at the moment. And it's, what does NDIS fund? What don't they fund? How come that person got approved, but this one didn't? Or why did that decision get made, even though my situation seems worse than the other person and I got denied? So I think there's inconsistency. And I think that's where it needs to tighten up, because you just get people scratching their heads going, well, why is that person getting access but I can't? Or, and I think that's the thing that really makes the difference. And I hear Mr. Shorten and the teams at the state level also about cutting out some access to some groups. So people with autism, for example, or people where they say, oh, maybe the services they need shouldn't be through NDIS. Maybe they should be through the state government services. Maybe we need to not try and do everything with NDIS. And I think that's maybe something that they're talking about there. And I think if we don't get that right, though, on the ground, that's the thing that worry for this one for me, because I think when they make decisions, they kind of make no kind of criteria. And NDIS and disability, it's all very individual. If it just means that, you know, you get a yes or a no matter what your situation is, it kind of makes it hard for people when they live in different places and they have different things going on. Someone that lives in the bush, might need different types of things than someone living in the city. And I think if they make criteria that aren't helpful, it might actually make it really, really hard.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for sharing that with us. We were talking about early interventions, enhancing early intervention programs to better support individuals with disabilities from an early age, potentially reducing the need for more incentive support later in life. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's interesting from a couple of different angles, because I find sometimes with disability funding, it's often, you know, doesn't usually get done properly until you're in the worst situation. So unless you're really screaming and yelling from the rooftop, they don't often action and get going on things. So sometimes it focuses on the worst situation, and it's always a crisis kind of approach. And I think early intervention makes life so much easier if you get really good support when you need it earlier on, whether you're a young person who's about to go in school, or whether you're an adult who maybe has acquired an injury or a disability who needs help straight away to try and look at rehab and things like that, might make a difference in a short amount of time. But if you leave it too long, it may not help. So I think early intervention is a really good one. I reckon that's the one that is going to be the big argument between the state government and the federal government, because I think that's the stuff that early intervention often happens in school settings, happens in the community settings. It needs to happen on little kids, you know, like kids that are maybe showing a need for some sort of disability-related early intervention when they're, you know, in that little age group of maybe between, you know, anywhere between 4 to 7, where you can't really wait until we get to school. You know, maybe we need to have those services before we get to school rather than sitting there, because a lot of that stuff works better the faster you get it. And maybe NDIS isn't the one to fund that, because they tend to fund one-on-one stuff. Maybe it needs to be funded through the state government and done in schools, or done by community organizations that can make that funding work a bit harder. So I think that'll be an interesting argument between the state and federal government, that one.
So, yeah, just in regards to the comments, we got Stephanie, who agrees with you. She lives in Bowen, a rural area. No support work is in her town of Bowen. Thanks for sharing that. So, yeah, there are a lot of people that live in the outback that do require the support, but they lack it because it's an ongoing crisis. So, like, my issue with my heart disease is my disability come to plus. Not on holidays with the disability person. Might be hard to find supports up there in the rural areas. We'll move on to the next question. In regards to increased funding and budget allocation, advocating for increased funding to better cover essential services like therapies and equipment required by individuals with disabilities. Meeting their needs. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's one of those ones too where regional Australia is really important to think about, because, say, if I was someone in the middle of outback Australia and I might need equipment for therapies or to work on things, you know, there's not a lot of gyms that I can just drop into, you know, whereas if I'm in the middle of Sydney, I've got my pick. And often if NDIS says, oh, we don't fund that, you go, well, you may not need to fund it for someone living in the middle of Sydney that where you've got 50 gyms within walking distance. But, you know, if I'm in the middle of outback Australia, you might have to fund it. So as long as those allocations of funding aren't that kind of robot algorithm that just says, oh, my computer says no, you know, as long as we don't take that approach, I think that's the important one. And we also need to make sure that just because it's a piece of equipment that I need for part of my disability support and it's funded by NDIS, you shouldn't be a reason for that person to put an extra 50% on the price. So, you know, if I get a wheelchair, just because it's going to be purchased by NDIS, it doesn't mean you need to add 10 grand onto the price. I think there's a bit of regulation that needs to come into this, because there's not much point putting more funding to it if I can, you know, if I can't afford basics. And I see that a lot. I see wheelchairs that my friend of mine gets from overseas that are probably a third of the price of what it would cost here in Australia, because it's technically an NDIS item. And I think that's one of the big tricks that we have to work on.
Interesting. That's a very good point. Jonathan, what are your thoughts in regards to increased funding and budget allocations?
Well, I think the NDIS should be part of the broader ecosystem.
Yep.
Created by the Australian Disability Strategy.
Yeah, for sure. Should play part of our strategy. All right, so we'll move on to the next question. Thank you for sharing. In regards to enhanced provider support, implementing measures to ensure a sufficient number of qualified service providers and enhancing their training to improve the quality of services that are offered. So, can you provide a comment on that?
Well, I think we've got enough service providers. I mean, there's thousands of them, and it's really hard to find a good one because you could look at the list and it's thousands and thousands. So I think it's really interesting to look at service providers and how we figure out whether the service provider I'm talking to does know what they're doing. I think that's the hard part of finding a service that knows what they're doing as well as has their heart in the right place. So I think just that quality side of that, I think would be a really important one to sort of go, well, I've got a list of 100 service providers. How do I figure out which ones to go with? And those service providers, you know, what training do they give their staff and what training do they have to give the staff? I think that's an interesting one, but I think we've got enough service providers. I'm not sure if I want more of them in a big way. I think it's good that you can set up a service provider organization, but I feel like we kind of need to just get back to making sure that the people that are setting those services up, there's some criteria that they have to meet, that it can't just pop up, do my own thing, sound like I know what I'm talking about, but not really. And then it kind of all falls in a heap. And usually it's the participant that suffers from that and then finds that the service provider they had goes out the window, because that's the tricky part. And I think with the federal system taking away the local side of that we used to have, I think it's harder for them to know if a service is really doing the right thing. So I think we need to have people with disabilities. We need to have advocacy groups that are checking up and doing the audits and making sure that service providers are up to scratch, because even with quality audits that service providers have to get already, it's really just policies and procedures that we're checking. We're not always checking the real on the ground stuff about, you know, do they know what they're doing? Because every service provider will advertise themselves as the best service provider who has participants at the focus of everything they do, and they're innovative and respectful and human-centered and all of the jargon. But when it comes down to it, it's, well, are you? You know, are all your staff agency staff? You know, do they speak English? Do they know what they're doing? Are they qualified? Will you fill my shifts? Will every third or fourth shift mean that I miss out on a shower or I don't get help that day because you can never fill my roster? You know, I think it's that kind of inconsistency. I think putting some focus on will help.
What will be your view in making quality and safeguard data more open source so consumers could compare like for like providers as they do in sectors such as education and health.
I think it's a hard one because, being able to find out that information and making it really easy to access when you're trying to figure out whether services are good or not is really tricky, because no one wants to dob themselves in when they're not doing a great job. And when they do the wrong thing, they like to hide. And then, with that education that's there, it's also the type of education. So what I found, like in the last couple of years with COVID, everyone went to online education. I've been teaching at TAFE and I've worked with, training organizations and mental health services and behavior support and all that kind of stuff. And you just can't do that online, you know. And I feel like you can't do really good training with people unless it's face-to-face in a room and you really regularly do it, you know. So I think that's a huge one to put some investment in, because I think good training and doesn't just happen once a year either, you know. So we'll say, oh, you've got to do your behavior support training once a year to be compliant. And it's like, well, yeah, but 12 months time, I can't remember what it is I was supposed to do. What was it I was supposed to do when that happened? I don't know. But technically, I only have to do the course once a year to remind myself. Those sorts of standards affect the training as well. So I think online training's great as a help, but I think we've got to get back to that face-to-face stuff. And a lot of services before NDIS, you know, like even like Family Plan in Queensland and, you know, New South Wales, and a lot of those state-based advocacy and community groups used to do really cool training for service providers. And a lot of that funding got cut when NDIS came in, and a lot of the, because the funds went from the state to the federal bucket of money. They didn't get replaced, so they just got lost. And a lot of those really cool training sessions done by people locally that knew what they're doing, we just lost them. So service providers now, they don't have as many options, I think.
Yeah. And I think there's a huge difference between, you know, applying the theory side of things as opposed to applying the practical side. And you know all the theory, you know, into about, you know, disability and how to work with people with disability. But I guess applying it in real life situations is on another level. Don't you agree?
Yeah, and you got to practice, don't you? You can't just do the course and then I'm now qualified. I used to do all sorts of training courses around behavior support, and we used to work in forensic settings and all sorts of scary stuff, as well as in the community. And you'd have to put people through it and say, I'm going to pretend to have a complete meltdown here and you're going to show me your best attempt and how you're going to help me. And it would be hysterical. People would have a panic attack. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know what to say. They're like, I've never been in this situation. And you'd go, well, the first time you do it, do you want to be doing it at Coles with the person you're supporting, or do you want to practice it in a classroom so at least you've got a bit of an idea? But even things like the manual handling side of it, helping someone get into a sling and move someone from a chair to a bed, it's not just moving them, it's getting them seated properly and comfortably and getting that clothing in the right place and moving their body around and adjusting them during the day. And there's a big difference between get someone into a chair and getting someone comfortable and, you know, able to sit there for a while because you've done it well. And that sort of stuff, you've got to practice it all the time. So when I was at TAFE, I used to freak out all my students. I'd throw them in a sling and lift them up and swing them around, and they'd be freaking out. And I'm going, yeah, this is what the people you're working with feel like. So if you, and don't say to me, oops, don't say that, you know, because now if I said that to you, you're freaking out going, what have I done? Oh, am I going to get dropped? And I'm like, that's exactly how the person you're working with feels. And they're like, I didn't realize what it was like. So I think that's the sort of training I want to see more of.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you for that. It's nice. So moving on, how are simplifying and streamlining administrative processes within the NDIS to reduce the bureaucracy and ensure a smoother experience for participants and their families?
Well, I think what I've seen a lot of over the last sort of few years with NDIS is they've gone away with that local contact person. So I think they're wasting a lot of funding on the muck around that you have to go through when something goes wrong, or someone's made a stupid decision, or they've forgotten to put the funding in your plan, or they just rolled over your plan, but they didn't bother to talk to you and see what you actually wanted, you know. Yeah, a lot of that kind of stuff just takes so much time. And what I've seen happen recently, you can't just go get the phone number for your local NDIS necessarily and the planner and go and meet them and have a chat, because they could be two states away, you know. And anytime there's a problem, it's like trying to call Centrelink. You kind of just think, I can't be bothered. It's too hard. And so I used to be able, when NDIS first rolled out, I'd ring up my local NDIS team leader and say, hey, one of your planners has done it again. They've stuffed this plan up. Can you please fix this? And they'd be like, okay, yep. Oh, look, I can see what they've done. Okay, yeah, I'll sort that out for you today. No problem. But now it's no, I'll have to escalate that. You'll have to put in a complaint. It'll take 3 weeks. It'll take 4 weeks for a phone conversation. You can't call us. We'll randomly call you while you're on the toilet. And if you miss that call, too bad, so sad. We may or may not call you back in the next week. You know, it's just creates so much time waste, which costs money. And I think we'd save billions of dollars just by getting rid of that and coming back to the local NDIS person or an LAC person that when there's a problem, I can just go in there and say, hey, can you help me fix this? And they have the power to just fix really simple stuff. Because most of the problems that I come across with people that talk to me are usually really simple stuff. Like, hey, they rolled my plan over. They didn't tell me. They forgot to put the funding in the... I can't get a hold of them on the phone to fix it. It's taken 3 weeks, you know, whereas if I had the local person I could roll into and go, hey, guys, can you fix this? They hop on the computer and go, obviously, that's a mistake. Yeah, give us 2 seconds. We'll sort that out. Because I've seen them sort it out quickly. And I think returning to local help, that's the big one for me.
I know. I totally agree with you. It is quite a process, an annoying four-stroke process. Just a going for Francis, we need to bring the human back into the NDIS. And I totally agree with you. Yeah,
it's make scary. It more it's quicker. Scary saying that. Is it kind of, to me, it's really scary that you have to go to something like NDIS and say, can you bring the human back into what you do? And that's, for me, that's the scary part. And then when I hear that Services Australia recording that says, you know, we will not tolerate abusive language or anything like that. It's like, okay, so the decisions and the stuff ups you make seriously impact my life, make me homeless, make me not have services. I can't have a shower. It's killing me. But I've got to be really nice and polite when I call you up for the 400th time and I don't want to upset you. So, and I'm like, I've had people say, look, I'm trying not to be rude and horrible, but it's been 3 weeks and no one's here to help me and this is your fault. Can you fix it? And they'll say, well, you cannot be abusive and growly. I'm like, I don't know how to say you're killing my life and ruining things in a nice way.
I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you. 100% feel you. I feel you, man. Thank you for showing that. By focusing on mental health and well-being, so recognizing and addressing mental health needs as a critical aspect of disability support, including access to appropriate mental health services. What are your thoughts on that?
I think we've always had that age-old kind of competition where disability departments will say, oh, we don't do mental health. That's not disability. And then mental health will say, oh, we don't do that because that's disability. And they argue back and forth. And in the meantime, someone's sitting there going, well, could one of you do something? And I think that's the thing of bringing back that local coordination because, you know, when we need to have that overlap of mental health and disability, there's no kind of gel. There's nothing gluing it, those services together. You know, if you get a really good support coordinator, maybe, but even still, they only have a certain amount of hours that they've got to do things. So I think that local, you know, how does the Department of Health connect and work with NDIS or disability services and mental health services? And what if I'm in that situation, like a lot of people, where they say, well, I'm sorry, you're not mental enough to access our service, but you are pretty bad, but there's nothing for you. But when you do get really bad, come back to us. An interesting one I had recently was a psychiatrist in a hospital who said after the person presented for the 10th time trying to kill themselves at home, they said, well, we've done our assessments and we don't feel they're psychotic and we don't feel that there's a mental illness here. And we go, well, they're not happy. They've tried to kill themselves 10 times. It's a bit more than just disability support here. There's this complex case management. And I think that's where we have a gap. We don't have that complex case kind of management where you can go to someone and says, you know what, this person needs disability services, mental health services, all working together. And then when I've done that in the past with people who have complex kind of support needs, you then also have to work with other departments like justice, you know, like because someone's not doing really well at home or they're having issues with mental health, they then come into contact with police who may or may not do the right thing and they may over respond or under respond. And now the person's going to court and then maybe they've got a mental health order and then we don't want them to go to prison because that's not where they need to be. But if they had the right service in place, they wouldn't be having the problem that's bringing them to the attention of police. So I think that complex case management's kind of disappeared and it needs to come back in that local coordination role. I think that's the navigator that we need through NDIS.
Yeah, totally. Thank you for sharing
that. Or they had overreaction by police. authority.
Overreaction by police is a big one because police, they don't get a lot of training either in disability and or anything. You know, I've got a friend who has cerebral palsy. Every time we go to the pub, he gets kicked out or the bouncer won't let him in or someone calls the police because they think he's drunk. And we'll say, we've only just got here. You know, this is the way this person walks already. No, they're not drunk. At Tourette Syndrome Association, I work with a lot. They will often have police and security staff that just don't know how to interact because they see something and they think, oh, this isn't okay. I don't understand what's going on. Or even at expos, I had I was at a huge expo in Perth, the Disability Connection Expo this year. And even the security staff at the venue there struggled. We had a young man who came up who had an intellectual disability. His speech wasn't that great. And he was saying he's lost his friend. But the security just went, oh, a child, you've lost a child. And they went straight into running around looking for this child. And I stopped and talked to him and said, tell me about your friend, you know. And after we talked for a while, we found out it wasn't a child. It was actually his friend, his own age. And he had a picture of his friend on social media that he could show us. And then we were able to find the person because we took 5 seconds to talk to the person like a normal human being instead of rushing and making assumptions. So I think you need that complex case management because mental health, disability, and then some of the behavior that pops up from that people think is, you know, big scary behavior that means that someone must be locked up, you know, doesn't need to happen if we coordinate it really well. And I think that's a thing that gets missed out when you go to a federal program without the local case management. So I think that's a thing that I think we should do really quickly as one of our first priorities with all the stuff that's coming out of the review and the reform work, I think.
Thank you for sharing, Uva. So talk about community and social inclusion initiatives. How does it feel to promote community involvement, social inclusion, and access to mainstream services to improve well-being of individuals with disabilities?
I always have a hard time when they talk about social inclusion because it kind of makes me feel like we're talking about people that aren't already here. And it's like we're kind of waiting in this little island and maybe if we can work out how to be included in the community, that'd be great. And it's like, I'm already living in the community. So I have a real problem when they talk about it because I'm like, when I go bowling, you know, that's not social inclusion. That's, you know, going on a sightseeing tour of the community. I'm in my own little alley. I'm not talking to anyone. That's not social inclusion. That's just going bowling. You know, it's sort of like, for me, it's about culture. So we need to educate Australia so that people actually are valued in the community. If you've got a disability, you're seen as a valued member of the community like anyone else. And it's not so much about inclusion because we have a right to be a part of that community. It's, well, what are the barriers? And the barriers are things like I may need equipment, I may need physical access, I may need a venue or access to the community that I don't have because right now it excludes me because of whatever diagnosis I have. So maybe I need staff to help me with something, but not all the time, but maybe just certain things. Or maybe, you know, I've got $60,000 to spend on social inclusion, but I can't get a taxi because there aren't any that have wheelchair access. Well, there's one for every 6,000 wheelchairs. So, and if I'm not going on a big enough trip, they won't come pick me up anyway. So it's kind of thing of, well, even if I did have the staff funding, I couldn't do what I wanted to do because I couldn't get a taxi to get there anyway. Or it's that kind of practical level of inclusion, I think, that we need to focus on. Like, what's the point of helping me get a job if I can't get to the job because there's no transport options for me? If the housing is designed to be inaccessible from the start, well, how do I access housing? You know, so I think it's that kind of barriers to being included that make a difference. And I don't think it's about being included. We already are there. It's more about how we're not included or how we're actually excluded right now. And that's the stuff I want to smash through with a sledgehammer.
Yeah, we all do. Thank you for that. There have been concerns about the high fees associated with attending disability conferences, hindering accessibility for many. What's your perspective on the economic accessibility?
There's sort of two sorts of events that are going on at the moment. There's the ones where we want to get all the service providers in a room and sort of get them to do better. And often those sorts of events, you know, they don't really have a lot of people with disability coming to them. because they're really expensive, you know. So I could go to a conference that might cost me $1,800 to go to, and I'm like, well, if I'm having a hard time paying rent, I can't pay $1,800. So if I'm going to an event like that, those sorts of conferences that are full of service providers where the conference purpose is a great one, but maybe it's also about just trying to make as much money out of the conference as humanly possible. So if I can make $2 million out of running a conference, whoopee, I'd love to do that. Yeah. But unfortunately, is that really helping people with disability, and is that helping shape it? So if I've got a whole bunch of service providers talking to other service providers about how to do a better job as a service provider, and I know that maybe if I actually had people with disability in the room, I actually might get it right. By charging so much, I miss that. And that's, I think, it's come out of the Royal Commission. It's come out of the RENDOS review that there shouldn't be anything about us without us, you know. So when you've got these crazy fees for conferences, I understand why they have to charge them because they have to pay for the venue. Because the venues could cost $20,000 or $30,000, but it's sort of what's the purpose of those conferences. So if you go to a conference that's all about getting people with disability and service providers and governments together to work out how do we implement these recommendations from the Royal Commission, then that sort of event needs to be something that anyone can access and anyone can go to, because the people that are experts in that room are the people with disability, not the service provider.
How do you believe it? Paid community participation representation.
It really stops you being able to participate and represent, you know, because you're kind of excluded by the price ticket. It's kind of like having a nightclub that costs $200 to get in and saying, well, anybody can come. We don't stop people from coming, you know, and it's like, well, yeah, you don't. The sort of conferences I need to see next year need to be free events that people with disability are the majority in the room, and they are the ones leading the discussion to show government agencies how to do things on the ground. And that's what I want to see, which is why the big disability connection expos that I'm involved with, they're all free. Service providers will pay money to be there, but we have free spots for advocacy groups. People with disability get free space there. We don't charge them anything because they're really cool. They need to be there. We'll charge the service providers who are making, you know, $20 million a year. If I'm going to sit down in a room and say, hey, let's all get together and work out how to sort out housing for people with disability, there's no point having a room full of housing providers because they're already doing the wrong thing. They're already not getting it, not hitting the mark. What's the point of them being in the room without the people that actually know what they're talking about? And what we end up with is the same thing we're currently seeing in the media, where we're going, let's fix the housing problem for people with disability. Let's focus on SDA housing. And it's like SDA housing, there's only like 3% of people on NDIS that can even access SDA housing. So what's the point of focusing on 3% of the people that are on NDIS, which also only represents 10% of the people with disability in Australia? What about the rest of the 98, you know? So they just missed the mark by not having us there, and excluding people by economics really sucks.
It does. It's something that we need to, I guess, look into and, I guess, improve. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our audience?
Well, I think for me, what I'm toying around with ideas that I'd love to get feedback on from everyone around Australia is all these conferences that are going on. I feel like we need to look at all the recommendations, and we need to get all the service providers and all the government agencies in rooms with people with disability and say, you know what, this is how you could practically solve these problems on the ground in a really simple way. And we're going to explain that to you and work together so that co-design is real, as opposed to, you know, just being told afterwards, after the decision's made. So what I'm floating around with, and I think what we need to do next year, is have a whole bunch of events that we just get people doing these sort of conference events, but they're free, that people with disabilities are running, advocacy groups are running, and service providers, agencies are in that room to learn and work together. Because until we stop being included and get treated as actually VIPs in that space, I think that's where we see the change that happens. Because until we have to stop saying, can you please let me come? As soon as I have to say that, I'm not included. I'm not valued. So when I have to stop asking to be included, then I know that you actually care about my opinion. And I think that's the thing we need to work on next year. So I'm floating these ideas around some events, and hopefully we can do some stuff like this that you know, uses the conferences, which I think are great, but the solutions need to come from us.
And I usually embed liberty experience into governance.
Yep.
Modeled more than having a token person with disability on a board.
Yeah, that token disability person with a disability, kind of obvious. Everyone knows what they're doing when they do it. That lived experience means that instead of being a policy person who is probably very intelligent, going, well, I reckon we should do this. If you talk to the people it affects, you know, you're going to come up with at least 10 more ideas that they didn't even think of. And that's what we need to do, I reckon.
You've been watching Cliff Tag, your weekly podcast on everything disability.
Yeah, so you've been watching Cliff Tag, your weekly podcast on everything disability. It was such an honor to have you, Mr. Ruben Hoyer, join us. I'm very pleased that you get the space. So, watch this space, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks so much for having me.